I've been playing you some strange music composed by Steve Reich. I just threw this in as an extra. This is a setting of Psalm 19 to his kind of music. It was done in 1982. He's a composer who lives in New York with a Jewish tradition behind some of his work. But also you've probably heard some African rhythms in there and some other kinds of music that he mixes in. The name of this album is Tehillim. That's how he pronounces it. It's a word that means psalms, and of course it's related to the Hebrew root HLL, which is based, on which other words are based as well. Can you think of any other words at this moment? And the reason I play this is that it reminds us of how ecstatic the psalms of praise are, that the traditional posture for songs of praise is this. Not this, looking down at the ground and hands folded, but open to God's presence and praising and being lifted outside yourself. And what's communicated in this song, to me at least, is the ecstatic or being lifted out of yourself sense of praise. That's what praise is for, to get you outside of yourself, not just to make a pious statement. And I think that the women singing and the clapping and all the song elements make that happen in this album. Are you plugged?
Yeah.
This doesn't need to be plugged in.
Well,
this does.
Your needles are moving,
sir.
No, I don't need one. My name is Janet Larson. I teach literature and a course in the Bible as literature at Rutgers University in New Jersey. I'm not a Hebrew scholar and I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm a reader of literature. And I'm going to invite you to read with me the Song of Songs tonight and to see what we can make of it as divine nonsense. The whole Bible is God's love story, if you think about it that way. God yearning for his or her creatures. It's a story in some ways of unrequited love, isn't it? And of our own restless quest for communion with the Creator. I put the First John text up here, God is love, to remind you of that. Theme song in the Bible. In the New Testament, probably the corresponding text to the Song of Songs is would be 1 Corinthians 13, this little sermon on love, St. Paul's sermon on love. I also put this up here for another reason. One of the texts I teach is E.M. Forster's novel, A Passage to India. Has anybody read that?
Yeah. It's a
video. It's a movie. It's also a movie now. That's right. Yeah, it's all a movie at least. Well, someday maybe you can read the book. but this is, I think, in the movie too. There's a moment. So Passage to India is about the need for Western people to take a passage into Eastern cultures. That's partly what it's about. The passage being the passage on the ship, but also other kinds of passage. And I suppose that you could say that it's about the transformation of consciousness of some of the characters. The Christians are not doing terribly well in India in this book, but there is one character, Mrs. Moore, who's venerated by a number of people in India, and she notices scrawled on a wall at one point in an Indian ceremony these English words. God see love. Kind of nonsense text based on the transposition of some letters. And in a way that the whole quest of the book has to do with questions of being and the transformation of being of people. Well, I'd like to look at the Song of Songs as a nonsense text about love with you tonight and share some ideas I have about it and then open it up to you. Probably what we'll do is I'd like to introduce it a little bit, tell you what biblical scholars say about the Song of Songs, what it is, how it got into the canon, and then we're going to read it together. I'm going to ask someone to read it with me, because I don't know how else we're going to talk about it if we don't read it, even though it's a bit long. And then I'd like to divide us up into some groups and each deal with part of the text and find the ways in which that text may speak to you and the ways in which it's divine nonsense. And then talk further about the kinds of confusion that we find in the Song of Songs and what value there may be in nonsense for Christians. And finally talk about the Song of Songs and divine love and the tradition of interpretation of this book. How many of you have read it recently? One, two, three, sort of, four, sort of. Okay, I guess we will need to read it then tonight. The title, I like this better than the Song of Solomon, though that it's also called that. Another of its titles is the Canticle of Canticles. And the title means the greatest song, as in the King of Kings. So there must be something superlative about this text, something that's very special. Well, what is it? That's the question. And what is it about? It's the only surviving instance we have of secular love poetry from ancient Israel. And more than that, it's a very erotic text. There's no question about that. Not by being explicit so much, but by being indirect, using sensuous imagery, metaphor, and simile, and the like. It's a very strange, almost psychedelic text. It's also all in voices, and in this it's kind of unusual. I mean, what you get usually in literature all in voices is a drama. A biblical narrative typically has a narrator who comes in at key points to guide the story or to give key information. Many biblical narratives communicate their ideas and values primarily through dialogue and through what the characters say. Well, this is all talking, all voices, and with no one to really tell us who's who, and when one voice ends and another begins. It doesn't have quotation marks in your King James Version. Okay, theories about what it is. We can't really recapture the life situation out of which this text arose, but there are a number of theories about it. One is that it's a cycle of wedding poems based on a 7-day wedding ceremony from the Assyrian peasantry. For example, in chapter 1, if you want to turn to it and just have it handy, it's right before Isaiah. You can find that. It's very short, actually. In chapter 1, the beloved is imaged as a shepherd and as a king. Well, in Assyrian peasant marriages, typically in some of the ceremonies, the bridal pair would play the roles of king and queen, even though they were peasants. So if there's some confusion in here about whether the speakers are peasantry or royalty, that's part of the context. I also thought in this connection of Rich Kemmerer's saying that used to be hanging around Holden, that God keeps taking beggars and making them kings and queens. And that's something of what happens in this crazy nonsense text about love. There are other elements that suggest Syrian peasant ceremonies that we'll look at later. A second theory is that it's an ancient Hebrew liturgy that's later been secularized as love poetry. And there it would have related to, possibly, a New Year festival of life that was celebrated to promote life in the womb and in the soil. And then the language of the song would be magical in making that fertility happen. If you say the words, you know, the words have power to make things occur. It would have been used probably in connection with a dance in the vineyards. And behind this, possibly preceding any Hebrew use of it, might have been fertility rites. It celebrated the reunion and remarriage of the sun god and the mother goddess way back in time. But that's all speculation. There were fertility cults in the ancient Near East that seem also to have made other contributions to this poem. For example, the fact that women are so prominent in the Song of Songs is suggested by the fact that in the liturgies of these cults, women are prominent leaders. Also, the plot of these other cults would have been something like this, that a goddess is separated from her beloved, and she is very aggressive in trying to reunite with him. And we'll see elements of that as we read it. There are parts of it that recall the story of Ishtar. Is there anybody in the room named Esther? No? You know anyone who is? You related to someone who is? Yeah, your mother, huh. Well, the name Esther etymologically seems to be related to the name Ishtar. She was the most widely worshipped of all the deities in the Near and Middle East, Babylonian, goddess of love and war. To the Canaanites, she was called Astarte. To the Israelites, Ashtoreth. Solomon built a temple to her. See how it might be related to Esther. And her worship involved ritual prostitution, which of course was condemned by the Hebrew prophets. But the story was that she loved Tammuz, who was a young fertility god. He died, went to the underworld, and she went after him, of course. And she had to go through 7 gates to get him back. And through each gate, she was divested of another piece of her clothing. Finally, she stands before the goddess of the underworld, imprisoned. And she is rescued only by magic spells and by something called the Water of Life. And she comes back to Earth with Tammuz. And if you look in 8:5, there's a remnant, possibly, of that. In the question, who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? I raised thee up under the apple tree. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. That idea of the lover coming up or in some kind of procession from the underworld might be related to the worship of Astarte. And there's also some generation of fertility imagery in that passage as well. Another contributing element are the rituals connected with Adonis, was a young god of vegetation who dies and is resurrected. And the cult involved planting gardens of Adonis, who is a masculine figure, around in the ancient world. Gardens of Adonis, they were called, and the festivals were celebrated all over the ancient world. Some elements of that in here, possibly, or the references to myrrh, as in, you know, the three kings who bring the myrrh. Well, myrrh was incense used at Adonis festival, and he was said to be born of Myrrh after she had been turned into a tree, hence the myrrh tree and so on. There's also reference in here to a nut garden, which was associated with Adonis cult. In 6:13, there is a cry, return, return, O Shulamite. That possibly is the return, return is the cry of the chorus in the Adonis festival as they cast their images of Adonis into the water. And in 2:7, the woman swears by animals that are associated with and sacred to Astarte. And she says, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, and so on. And she goes on to say, that ye stir not up nor wake my love till he please. Not meaning, you know, let him sleep a little longer exactly, but she's asking them to wait for the proper season for love, or the proper growing season for love to come about. Well, besides that kind of pagan imagery, there's also other fertility cult imagery. In fact, quite a lot of it. If you look in the Interpreter's Bible, you can find a lot of these references. It's kind of overwhelming at first. For example, there are references to spikenard, which was a love charm, to doves. Doves were not in the Old Testament symbol of the Holy Spirit, but a typical symbol for the fertility goddesses. The trees, the various trees mentioned are associated with different gods and goddesses. And we also have here in 1:14 a reference to my beloved, which apparently in transliterated Hebrew text would be this name right here, D-O-D-H, which is the name of a fertility god. Solomon, to whom these songs are attributed, is almost identical with the words Shelem, Shulman, which is another fertility god, and Shulamite, which is a word I read a minute ago, is a feminine form of this. Solomon, Shelem, Shulman, Shulamite, so on. Now, with all this paganism in here, how in the world did this ever get into the Hebrew scriptures? Well, that's a good question, and I wish I were around about the first century B.C., A.D., to have heard the debates. They must have been very interesting. And, of course, they went on after that, too. Song of Songs was written down between 300 and 200 B.C., probably, but the songs could have gone back to the time of Solomon. They may have been a series of marriage songs that were used then in Solomon's time. They were accepted into the Hebrew canon at the school of Jamnia in the first century, but that doesn't mean that the whole issue was settled. They kept on debating of whether the Song of Songs should be in the canon or not. There were a couple other books they debated too that they couldn't quite make up their mind about. Do you know which ones, or can you guess which other ones might have been questionable like this one?
The story of Susanna and Daniel?
Well, that never did get in.
Until lately.
Well, yeah.
I mean, was the maid in, or?
What?
Did not?
Yeah, but it did, but just barely by the skin of their teeth, so to speak.
Anyone? Esther, I imagine, was
yeah. The Book of Esther. Really? God's not in there any more than in the Song of Songs. And also Ecclesiastes, which has a lot of sort of pagan philosophy in it and other kinds of doubtful things. Well, anyway, the Hebrew Bible, as you may know, is divided into three parts, the laws, the prophets, and the writings. And the writings is really sort of the miscellaneous category. And the Song of Songs fits into that along with five other books that are seen together as the five scrolls, the Song of Songs, Ruth, somebody mentioned that a minute ago, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. And three of those are dominated by female figures of those school books. One of the disadvantages of the Song of Songs labored under was the fact that it may have been used later on as a drinking song, part of it anyway, but that doesn't necessarily mean it couldn't have been in the scripture. But it got in partly because it was attributed to Solomon. You know, and if you attribute something to someone as important in the tradition as Solomon, why, how can you leave it out? Now, Solomon wrote it. 1,005 songs were attributed to Solomon. This is one of them. Also, it got in, and this is the issue that we'll want to talk about more later, because it was allegorized. The prophets, of course, had used marital imagery for Israel, for the Jewish nation, for example. And there are many, but Isaiah 62, verse 5, it's the image is worked with like this: "For as a young man marrieth a virgin, so shall thy sons marry thee. And as the bridegroom rejoiceth over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee." And so on. And so that kind of imagery was standard and could be used to justify the inclusion of this text as another example of a text that speaks about God's relationship to Israel as bride. And in the New Testament, of course, the bridegroom is treated as Christ, the bride is the church. In Roman Catholic circles, and I'll say a little bit more in a minute about traditional interpretations of this book, the heroine of the Song of Songs was identified with who else but the BVM for a time, who was Blessed Virgin Mary. In 5:9, there's a reference to the beloved as the fairest among women. And so naturally, yes, right. Subject of many beautiful pictures. And of course, it couldn't not be claimed that, that the text is wrong, since if it's about married love, sexuality is affirmed in Genesis 2. We were talking about that the other day, and Adam's cry of joy as he greets Eve. And there's a very strong sort of creation, well, I wouldn't call it theology exactly, but there's certainly a very strong strand in the Old Testament of celebration of the created world, something that we post-Pauline people have more difficulty with sometimes, and we forget about. In the Middle Ages, just to give you some idea of how important this seemingly obscure book is, in the Middle Ages, the early bibliographies listed more commentaries on the Song of Songs than on any other biblical book except Psalms, Paul's Epistles, and the Gospels. So the most popular of the Old Testament books for commentaries. Now that in itself is important.
I wonder what Jerome said.
Be interesting to see, I don't know. By the 13th century, there were 60 to 70 such commentaries extant, and at least 500 through the 17th century. So people were very much into interpreting the Song of Songs. As we read it, you'll see why. You know, what in the world does it mean? It evokes that human impulse to interpret and to try to figure it out. In the High Middle Ages, it was considered in some ways the pinnacle of Scripture. As the place where God's love, particularly Christ's divine love, is no better taught than in the Song of Songs. And there are innumerable sermons on it, as well as its prominence in the tradition of mysticism and in Protestant spirituality, although in a different way. And there are many, many tracts and sermons on marriage that use the Song of Songs. Well, I want to talk to you about just a couple of things about the Protestant reformers and how they dealt with it and how important it was even for them. One of the reformers, Sebastian Castellio, maintained that since the book was nothing but a dialogue between Solomon and his beloved Shulamite woman. Of course, as you know, Solomon had many wives. How many was it? 500 or... I can't remember the number, but it was a quite extraordinary number. And this is one of them. Since it was nothing but that, the song had no spiritual significance. Mentioning earlier in the week, it's a very interesting book about biblical storytelling. It has the poem has what you might call narrativity. That is, it seems to begin to tell a story and then breaks into something else from time to time. So if you're wondering what's the plot, keep wondering that. That's one of the questions that the text wants you to ask, I think. It's not one that's going to be clearly answered. I'd like to read this with someone. I have no idea how long it will take, but you can just kind of read it quickly, I think.
Can I ask a question?
And I need to have a male voice. Yes.
What was the oral tradition? Was it presented with several people in a chorus, in a group, or was it sung with a lyre by one person? Or is there?
There's no way to know that. I think it could have been any of those things, and danced and sung and so on. Perhaps sung like the music I was playing before. I don't think that was before you came in. With the timbrels and clapping and voices and drums. It might have been that kind of background for it. We can't sing and dance it tonight. Would somebody be willing to come up here and read this with me? Well, yes, because I have to give you the cues as to when the lines come in.
I would.
With the King James?
Yeah.
Would you come up and do it? If you get tired, you know, we can switch off and somebody else can.
There's a chair.
She'll need a chair. Yeah. You can tell us later if this corresponds with your division of the lines. I've got mine underlined in pink for the female voice. And blue for the male voice. Why not?
Why not? Okay. We share.
It's color coding, yeah. The first verse is the title, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's, and I'll start.
I'm
and then
colorblind,
you.
So you have to pull.
Oh, are you really?
I'll manage.
Okay, right here. Okay. It's a little hard to see him. Okay.
I'll manage.
All right. We don't have to do a dramatic reading. Just let, you know.
Not
no,
dramatic.
We will not act it out. Okay. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. Because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name is as ointment poured forth. Therefore do the virgins love thee. Draw me, and we will run after thee. The king hath brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will remember thy love more than wine. The upright love thee. See. I am black but comely, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar, as the curtains of Solomon. Look not upon me because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me. My mother's children were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but mine own vineyard have I not kept. Tell me, O thou whom my soul lovest, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon. For why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companions?
If thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock, and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tents. I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses and Pharaoh's chariots. Thy cheeks are comely with rows of jewels, thy neck with chains of gold. We will make thee borders of gold with studs of silver.
While the sun sitteth, the king sitteth at his table. My spikenard sendeth forth the smell thereof. A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night betwixt my breasts. My beloved is unto me as a cluster of campfire, a in the vineyards of En-Gedi.
Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes.
Behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant. Also our bed is green.
The beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters of fir.
That last bit from 12 to 17 is considered the dialogue of the bride and groom. That's one of the titles given to it anyway. Okay, and then I start and then you do one verse. And then you I am the rose of Sharon and a lily of the valleys.
As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters.
As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the...
By the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up, nor awake my love till he please.
Actually, I think that was
I
my line.
I think it was yours.
Yeah, I see if that was in the wrong color. The voice of my beloved, behold, he cometh leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. Yeah. My beloved is like a roe or a young hart. Behold, he standeth behind our wall. He looketh forth at the windows, showing himself through the lattice. My beloved spake and said unto me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. The fig putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. O my dove that art in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the stairs, let me see thy countenance, let me hear thy voice, for sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. Take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. My beloved is mine, and I am his. He feedeth among the lilies. Until the day break, and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be thou like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of Bether. By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets and in the broad ways. I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchmen that go about the city found me, to whom I said, saw ye him whom my soul loveth? It was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loveth. I held him and would not let him go until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me.
I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up, nor awake my love till he please.
What he's reading is, I think, the chorus lines. Yeah, that's what that is. So you see, you don't have very many lines, do you?
I just hold the spear. Yeah.
Who is this that cometh out of the wilderness, like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? Behold his bed, which is Solomon's. 70 valiant men are about it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man hath his sword upon his thigh because of fear in the night. King Solomon made himself a chariot of wood of Lebanon. He made the pillars thereof of silver, the bottom thereof of gold, the covering of it purple, the midst thereof being paved with love for the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O ye daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals and in the day of the gladness of his heart.
Behold, thou art fair, my love, behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Mount Gilead. Thy teeth are like a flock of sheep that are even shorn, which came up from the washing, whereof every one bare twins, and none is barren among them. Thy lips like a thread of scarlet, and thy speech is comely. Thy temples are like a piece of pomegranate within thy locks. Thy neck is like the tower of David, builded for an armory, whereon there hang 1,000 bucklers, all shields of mighty men. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies. Until the day break, and the shadows flee away, I will get me to the mountain of myrrh, and to the hill of frankincense. Thou art all fair, my love. There is no spot in thee. Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, with me from Lebanon. look from the top of Amana, Iowa, from the top of Chenier and Hermon, from the lion's dens, from the mountains of the leopards. Thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. Thou hast ravished my heart with one of thine eyes, with one chain of thy neck. How fair is thy love, my sister, my spouse? How much better is thy love than wine, and the smell of thine ointment than all spices? Thy lips, O my spouse, drop as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under thy tongue, and the smell of thy garments is like the smell of Lebanon. A garden is enclosed is my sister, my spouse, a spring shut up, a fountain sealed. Thy plants are an orchard of pomegranates, with pleasant fruits, campfire with spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices. A fountain of gardens, a well of living waters and streams from Lebanon.
Awake, O north wind, and come thou south, blow upon my garden, that the spices thereof may flow out. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits.
Yeah. I am come into my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends, drink, yea, drink abundantly, O beloved.
I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is a voice of my beloved that knocketh, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled. For my head is filled with dew, and my locks with the drops of the night. I have put off my coat, how shall I put it on? I have washed my feet, how shall I defile them? My beloved put in his hand by the hole of the door, and my bowels were moved for him. I rose to open to my beloved, and my hands dropped with myrrh, and my fingers with sweet-smelling myrrh upon the handles of the lock. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone. My soul failed when he spake. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. The watchmen that went about the city found me. They smote me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took away my veil from me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if ye find my beloved, that ye tell him that I am sick of love.
What is thy beloved more than another beloved? O thou fairest among women, what is thy beloved more than another beloved, that thou dost so charge us?
That was a daughter of Jerusalem asking that question. Mm-hmm. My beloved is white and ruddy, the chiefest among 10,000. His head is as the most fine gold. His locks are bushy and black as a raven. His eyes are as the eyes of doves by the river of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. His cheeks are as a bed of spices, as sweet flowers. His lips like lilies dropping sweet-smelling myrrh. His hands are as gold rings set with a beryl. His belly is as bright ivory overlaid with sapphires. His legs are as pillars of marble set upon sockets of fine gold. His countenance is as Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. Yea, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. You daughters.
Whither is thy beloved gone, O thou fairest among women? Whither is thy beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with thee?
My beloved is gone down into his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feedeth among the lilies.
Thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. Turn away thine eyes from me, for they have overcome me. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Gilead. Thy teeth are as a flock of sheep which go up from the washing, whereof everyone beareth twins, and there is not one barren among them. As a piece of a pomegranate are thy temples within thy locks. There are 70 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of her that bare her. The daughters saw her and blessed her, yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners? I went down into the garden of nuts to see the fruits of the valley and to see whether the vine flourished and the pomegranates budded. Or ever I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon thee. What will ye see in the Shulamite, as it were, the company of two armies? How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter! The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Thy navel is like a round goblet, which wanteth not liquor. Thy belly is like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins. Thy neck is as a tower of ivory. Thine eyes are like the fish pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath-Rabim. Thy nose is a tower of Lebanon which looketh toward Damascus. Thy head upon thee is like Carmel, and the hair of thine head like purple. The king is held in the galleries. How fair and how pleasant art thou, O love for delights! This thy stature is like to a palm tree, and thy breast to clusters of grapes. I said I will go up to the palm tree, I will take hold of the boughs thereof. Now also thy breasts shall be as clusters of the vine, and the smell of thy nose like apples, and the roof of thy mouth like the best wine for my beloved,
that goeth down sweetly, causing the lips of those that are asleep to speak. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourisheth, whether the tender grapes appear and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give thee my loves. The mandrakes give a smell, and at our gates are all manner of pleasant fruits, new and old, which I have laid up for thee, O my beloved. O that thou wert as my brother that suckled the breasts of my mother. When I should find thee without, I would kiss thee, yea, I should not be despised. I would lead thee and bring thee into my mother's house, who would instruct me. I would cause thee to drink of the spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand should be under my head, and his right hand should embrace me.
I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that ye stir not up nor awake my love until he pleased.
And from here on, there's different voices that kind of change back and forth. So I'm just going to read this part. There's a question. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? I raised thee up under the apple tree. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. Set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath the most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would be utterly contemned. And then the brothers say, you want to say that,
sure.
These two brothers?
We have a little sister, and she hath no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? If she be a wall, we will build upon her a palace of silver. If she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar.
I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. Solomon hath a vineyard at Baal Haman.
Be free to say.
He let out the vineyard unto keepers. Every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. Thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companions, hearkeneth to thy voice. Cause me to hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. There are about there are a lot of ways you could probably deal with this and divide it up. There are about five parts, and they're generally thought of as broken up by the things that end each section, which is usually that, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, that line is typically thought of as one of the framing devices. And then oftentimes the next is a question. For example, in chapter 5, verse 9, a section begins maybe, what is the beloved more than another beloved, O thou fairest among women? A question of the daughters of Jerusalem. So ending with those choruses and beginning with questions, that seems to be the structural device. Now, biblical stories typically go somewhere, and even biblical poetry goes somewhere. But does this story go anywhere? Okay. Typically, biblical storytelling has some kind of teleology, some kind of forward thrust and forward direction. This book kind of goes in circles and seems to have no end and no end outside of itself, rather like erotic experience. You might say, though, that the end is implicit in all the cycles that these lovers go through, if you wanted to read God into all of those cycles. Let me ask you, since we don't have time really to break up into groups, I think I'm just going to have to talk out boldly here. What are the things in this book that struck you as being really nonsensical and maybe typical of love poetry?
Metaphors.
Where, for instance?
The teeth, like the ewes, the sheep.
Uh-huh.
All these sheep.
And it was repeated.
He was doing it sheep, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It kept coming back over and over again.
What do you think that means?
The brightest thing he had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He could have said ivory.
Not a single barren one among them.
It sounds like she had a lot of them.
Like,
no holes.
Well,
no.
But what's strange about that simile? My teeth are like a flock of sheep. What is strange to you about that? I mean, it's in a peasant culture where there are sheep, and, you know, it's a thing you
but
would...
The teeth are not usually thought of as animate moving around, in my mind. You know,
well, really, sheep doesn't,
when
very
I
much
see
of a lie.
Sheep, you know, they're kind of bouncing around the hills or wandering around or something.
It's a far-out kind of comparison, isn't it? And there are a lot of those in here that seem extreme to us, although some of them would be appropriate in their context. Try these compliments out on your wife and see what happens.
Probably nothing.
It's an architectural image, and it would have been considered a compliment. I mean, the tower is a symbol of security and of regal stature and so on. So
probably one of the finest structures in the city.
Yes, that's right. Anybody else? What's strange and kind of nonsensical about this text?
Well, in the very beginning, it seemed like she was putting herself down. She said she would look not upon me because I am black. And then but a chapter later, when she was talking about finding Rose of Sharon. And I couldn't get a sense of who she was and how she felt about herself.
It's not a poem that you can psychologize about. Is it really? You can't apply psychology to this and figure out what kind of people these are. They're not realistic characters. And that business about her being black but comely is picked up by Toni Morrison in her novel Song of Solomon, which is about all kinds of love. I'm going to talk about this some more tomorrow and read you some passages out of this that will remind you of the Song of Songs, only rewritten in a modern idiom. But, of course, her main characters are all black and quite comely in their way. What else is nonsense here to you? You were going to say something. Yes?
Well, the brothers were speaking at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
We have a little sister, and she hath no breast. And it says, if she be a wall, you know, and he talks about her being a wall. You know,
The wall or the door.
It's good to be a wall. It's not so good to be a door.
Don't be a door.
If your sister is a door, you've got to shut her up, keep her inside.
Exactly.
Wayward.
But the whole thing is that it would be the door.
Yeah, it is.
All of a sudden, it's like speaking of baseball.
You got this little sister.
I think the end is kind of a patchwork of a number of proverbs and other things that kind of are tacked on together there. But the last line brings back the imagery of the whole again, doesn't it?
One of the longest passages of story seemed to me that place where she was alone and the beloved shows up and he puts his arm through the door and she gets up and hustles to the door, but by the time he gets there, he's gone. She calls after him. Then she goes out and gets beaten up by the night watchman. What in the world is that about?
Who
you
knows?
Don't know either.
Maybe she
you
was call
this divine nonsense.
Yeah.
It's clearly nonsense. Why is it divine?
Thank you.
Well, if there's a better answer than that, I'd like to hear it. That's the one that I would have used if somebody had asked me.
That's one of the ways in which it is nonsense in a number of places, that the whole story is not told. The explanations are not there. Appearance, disappearance. The lover is intimate and then distant. Even in it's registered even in things like pronouns. Her first line is, "Let him kiss me, for thy love is better than mine." Switching from third person to second person, sort of like sudden intimacy, and then it will drift out again later on. I suppose one of the ways that that might have been interpreted is a kind of allegory of God's presence and absence, or of leaving, or if you want to look at it the other way around, depending on who plays the role of God in the text, and of course that's entirely up to us, it's not in here in any explicit way, then maybe the disappearing lover is Israel. I mean, I don't know, but that could be one way that could be interpreted.
Seems to
I want to talk some more about the divine nonsense at the end if we have some time.
It seems to me that this could have been just over the years gotten jumbled up like that. And
yeah.
Just showing different facets of love. I mean, anticipation, comes to the door and he's gone. You know. But it is not just one story. It's just a bunch of different bites coming from different.
Are you saying that the copies that the frustrated old monks made in the Middle Ages could have transformed this from something that was coherent to something that's incoherent?
No, I think it was incoherent before they got it. One of the things that might be behind that appearance and disappearance is that there were hide-and-seek games in some of the Syrian wedding ceremonies, in which everybody sort of looked for the bride, but only the groom got to find her.
Easter egg.
What? Like an Easter egg hunt? Yeah. Robert Alter, who wrote this book I held up a minute ago, The Art of Biblical Narrative, also has a book called The Art of Biblical Poetry, which has an interesting chapter on the Song of Songs called The Garden of Metaphor. And he talks about the relationship between this poetry and other biblical poetry. And one of the things he discusses is the kind of imagery that's used in this song. And he mentions several kinds of imagery you find elsewhere in the Bible. For instance, in Psalms, you find references to God as a rock. Those are conventional images. You see them all over the place in the scripture. They turn up again and again. There are some of those same conventional images made a little more interesting by putting next to other interesting images by being repeated. He calls those intensive images. And then there are others called innovative images, like in the book of Job, life is compared to backbreaking day labor. And there are a lot of other really wild images for God as a monster and other kinds of things in the book of Job that suggests that the writer there was a poet who wanted to break up conventional associations and was a kind of rebel against received ideas about wisdom. I sometimes teach the book of Job as another book about divine nonsense of a very anguished kind, along with the Song of Songs as a book of divine nonsense of a more playful and pleasurable kind.
But how is it that Job is nonsense in the same way that this is nonsense?
To him, there's a lot of nonsense in Job, things that don't make sense to him. The world order does not make sense to him in the middle for a very long while.
Long while?
Yeah.
But then it does.
That's right. That's part of the nonsense all of a sudden.
But that's
there's a lot of irony. There's a lot of irony in Scripture that is comic irony. In fact, that seems to be the most common kind, though not the only kind, in which things look real bad for a while and then, you know, all of a sudden things are okay. And that happens in the book of Job. It's one of the ironies of that. But in the middle, there's a lot of other stuff going on that's nonsensical. Getting back to the Song of Songs, one of the things, crazy kind of things that happens here is that it's hard to tell what's being compared to what. and it's one of the forms of nonsense that we find in this book. You might remember from your high school English days or college days that there is a, we'll just call it an image, a concrete image, like lilies or something. And then there is something to which the image refers, the referent. And the image is the concrete thing, the referent is the idea or the feeling that it refers to. And that's all very nice. And you can talk about, you know, metaphor and simile in terms of one thing being compared to another thing and making it more concrete. Well, in the Song of Songs, the imagery doesn't work the same way it does anywhere else, in that it's hard to tell what's figurative and what's literal and what's being compared to what. Let me give you some examples of that. For instance, in the chapter 2, verse 8, if thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock, and feed thy kids by the shepherd's tent. I have compared thee, O my love. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, that's chapter 1. I'm reading the wrong place. Although there's some interesting things going on up there too. But if you look at 2:8, she says, the voice of my beloved, behold, he cometh leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills. And then my beloved is like a roe or a young hart. Behold, he standeth behind our wall. He looketh forth at the window, showing himself through the lattice. Now, is that the hart looking through the lattice, or is that the lover looking through the lattice? What's being compared to what exactly? And she goes on, for lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. You've probably heard this read at a wedding before. The flowers appear on the earth. When is it? Is it literally spring, or does it become spring when you're in love? Is the language meant to be literal, or is it meant to be figurative? Is there a comparison being made, or is it just meant to be taken straight? The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, come away, she says. Later on, in verse 14, you can't really tell whether the landscape is a metaphor for the body of the beloved, or whether it's an actual landscape where they really are. You know, the places are confused. Timing is confused. We don't know when happened. And then, you know, stories are not completed. Any other kinds of nonsense that occurred to you as I was talking?
What's the voice of the turtle?
Yeah. The turtle dove?
Turtle.
Voice of the turtle.
Turtle dove.
Think so?
That's what I've always thought, right? Yeah?
Mm-hmm. You were talking about birds.
You were saying an actual turtle.
Yeah. Well, I thought that fit in.
What?
Who wrote the play voice of the
turtle? I can't remember.
Of course, it had silence in that
One of the reasons I think it's difficult to tell who is speaking when is that they keep calling each other the same epithets. Did you notice that? And there are all sorts of ways in which they are wrapped up with one another in the language. Now, we're going to have to go to Vespers, and I won't be able to tell you very much about the divine love in here. There's just too much to talk about in this text. So I suggest that if you're interested, you might come back tomorrow. I think it's 4 o'clock, same place. And we'll talk a little bit more about this as well as other kinds of love poetry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.